The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
After lunch logistics, there's a few things to talk about. Two things on our minds as your teachers are the upcoming paper that's due. That's one thing. And then our overnight offsite retreat in February when we meet next. So those are two things we know we want to talk about at this juncture. So how about if we jump into those, and then if people have other questions, offerings, fill in the blanks, we'll do that also in this segment. Sound good? Okay, great. So I'll start with the writing assignment, Gil, and then you can talk about IRC. So we're going to be writing a different kind of paper and doing a little questionnaire for the, and you're going to bring this paper to our in-person meeting in February. And by that, I mean, you'll print it and you'll bring it with you, because we'll be doing some small group work where you won't read the paper necessarily to people, but you'll want to be looking at what you've written, and also the question and answer multiple choice section. You'll want to look at your answers. Yeah. And then in whatever manner you usually send papers to your reader, you can do it the same manner. You don't need to give the piece that's in your lap in February to the teacher that day. You can, but yeah. The subject is religious history. So some of the competence of chaplains, as we've talked about, is a self-understanding and awareness and understanding. And there's also a fair amount of articulating who you are and what you're about as a chaplain to other people. And one part of this is one's own religious identity, which includes one's religious history. Yeah. One's religious identity can include a religious denomination, an ordination, the language that you use. And your religious identity, you might explain at great length to some people in person, or your religious identity, you may need to be able to say it really quickly and succinctly to kind of help people get a bit of a toehold on who you are and then go on from there. So within the religious identity is one's own history, like, how did I get here? So like for me, if I was in the elevator with you and I had the chaplain badge on, and you said, oh, you're the chaplain, you know, what kind are you? Sometimes people will ask. They're not always that bold in the elevator, but let's just assume they are. I just would say, well, I'm a Zen Buddhist and a mystical Christian. And I come from a family of people engaging in lots of different religious traditions. And if it's a really tall building, I might even say, I think there's lots of ways to understand the divine. I might say that. So that's just a little introduction. Yeah. Now, how did I get here? In chaplaincy and other forms of ministry, when people are looking to invite you into their institution, they want to know who you are. And that includes, they want to know about your religious identity and history. So history, you know, I was born into this. Growing up, I engaged in that. For those not born into the Dharma, what was the path to Dharma practice? And do you have other spiritual practices? So in the assignment itself, there are several prompts of just questions for you to answer. As well as about a 12 or 15 point questionnaire. So that's the assignment. And in the writing, like the papers we've been writing so far, we hope that you will be reflective as you write, saying, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but all these decades later, I can see that for me, for example, being a Girl Scout was incredibly formative for me in so many ways. You know, I learned about the company of women and the power that that is. As a Girl Scout, I was really encouraged and kind of wasn't exposed to thinking along the lines of, well, you're a girl, so you can only do this and not that, you know. And I still carry that attitude with me to this in this day and age. You know, like I encounter sexism, but I don't have an internalized sexism, I think because I was in the Girl Scouts and raised also in a feminist household in the 70s. And I even still have my Girl Scout sash and badge and keep it on my altar with other things that are sacred to me, you know. And if I was with a bunch of Zen Buddhists, I might even say that was my first rakusu, you know, my little Girl Scout sash. You know. There's lots of little stitches and putting the badges on. And there were a lot of ways in my childhood where I was lost on my own, had a lot of anxiety. And I shudder to think what would have happened if I hadn't had the grounding of the Girl Scouts. It was a buoy for me in a stormy time. And I don't remember there being much talk about God in my Girl Scout troop. I understand in others it was a little bit different. But I do remember that the Girl Scout promise is something along the lines of loving and serving God, being a good person and helping other people. So to me, that is very similar to the Bodhisattva vow, which is something I've done more recently than the Girl Scouts. Yeah. So that's a paragraph. That's a good, juicy paragraph, right? If you stop there. So that's what we want to see is kind of like not just what happened, but how did you get there? If there's some parts of your history that you feel very vulnerable around and you don't want to write about them, I appreciate that. I can understand that. You could even write a little bit about it and say, and I don't feel comfortable writing much more. This is really big territory for me, you know. So at least as the reader, I would know there's something in the religious history that is too hard to put in writing and have somebody else read at this time. Yeah. But, you know, lean towards writing about it or at least something, you know. And it should be 3 to 5 pages, single spaced. If you don't know where to start, I would say start with your family of origin and your upbringing, and then move on to if you worshiped any other gods like drugs and alcohol or social action or world travel, you know, if those are all part of your spiritual seeking, then include those or whatever else, or raising children, whatever that might be. But which churches did you go to or temples? Why did you go? Why did you not go? How did you get into the Dharma? What was the first door you knocked on? There's lots of doors in this part of the world, you know, enter the Dharma. In terms of feedback, I don't give a lot of feedback on this paper besides thank you for sharing your story with me. You know, I think it's important to give your writing to somebody else and have them read it. There's a lot to learn just in that process. But this is not something that will be evaluated for some form of goodness. We'll just presume benevolent goodness in whatever you write. Any questions? Raise your hand if you've written anything like this before. One. And one flutter. Okay. You may, if you've applied to a theological program or clinical training as a chaplain, you may have written some of this already. So that's it about the papers. Yeah. And if you need to write the paper, because if you don't, then what are you going to talk about when we get together in February? So even if you're behind on other papers, let them stay like that, but do this one for the next class. Oh, okay. Anything to add, Gil?
If you find it very easy to write this and it flows through because it's, you've done it before, you're familiar with all this, when you finish, put it down, come back a few days later and read it, and then think more deeply. So that what you, it's, this is all for your benefit, this writing. It's not for anybody else's benefit. So if it's really easy to write, maybe it doesn't push your edges, or I don't know if edges is the right word, but push you into new territory with all this. And the religious history is, even if you don't have no religious history, the absence of religious history is a very significant thing. And to kind of explore the depths of it, or the fullness of your experience, and what influences, your background influences what you do today. It's really important for anybody who does chaplaincy, because it'll be with you in the room, regardless of whether you know it or not. But it's better to know it.
Right. Yeah. Right. I think in the past, too, some people in writing the assignment have, something's been almost, comes into some reconciliation for them. Like in some ways, their religious past has been a little bit left behind, or has a sense of being a bit of a stone in one shoe, and writing the paper can kind of help one feel more current, or even kind of get that little stone out of their shoe and say, oh, that's better. I just needed to revisit it and rethink it now, and might look back at that now compared to the way I saw that situation when I was 10, 15, 20, 25, etc. Yep. Cool. Great. Well, enjoy. And you'll also be giving this paper to your buddy, but I don't know. Maybe that's who you'll give the paper to at the end of our February retreat. Okay. Done? All right. Done.
Good.
I'm going to pass it over to Gil to talk about the retreat.
So we're going to meet. Next time we meet is 2 days, a Friday and a Saturday, first Friday and Saturday of February, at Insight Retreat Center in Santa Cruz. And you should have received the registration link for it. And if you haven't, it's on Slack, the Slack channel for everybody. And how many have filled it out so far? So good. So the reason to fill it out is that IRC is completely run by volunteers, and we never charge for what we do down there. It's always offered freely. But to have the whole complicated kind of thing of a retreat center and staffing and cooking and managing and all done by volunteers, and we manage because everything's has systems, and if you participate in the system, the process is set up there, then it all goes smoothly for everyone. So it's just kind of an automatic almost. As soon as there's an exception, it's like someone has to kind of figure out what to do. So part of the system is to register. And so it'd be good if you could do that in the next week, because if not, someone's going to email me, Gil, what about those chaplaincy students? And then I have to kind of figure out who's not doing it and ask you to do it. And then you see it's the whole system starts getting slowing down. So to fill it out, it's just nice. And then if you've never been there, I think you'll have a wonderful time. I think it's a very common experience where people just show up on the property or show up in the building and something relaxes inside of them. They feel like, oh, now they're in a good place. And so hopefully that's what you'll experience. And it's a phenomenal field of goodwill that's down there, because it's all done by volunteers and people who are wanting to do it. And if you're coming from far away, if you want to come the night before, there's an option for that. But no one will make you supper, and probably no one will make you breakfast. But But if you come the night before, and also you can stay the night after if you want, Saturday night, if that's easier for you, so rather than driving home in the dark or something. So as it just, I think in the registration, you can indicate what you want, or later you can email the registrar for it. And you'll all have your own room there, and you will, you know, it's all vegetarian food bordering on vegan. It's basically vegan, but there's sometimes a little bit of cheese on the side or something. And so anything you need to know, it helps if you bring your own linen. We have linen down there and towels, but we always ask for a retreat that people bring their own, because again, it's all volunteers, right? So if you use the IRC linen and towels, someone has to clean it, and we don't leave until everything's been cleaned. So it just makes it easier if you bring your own bring clean linen and towels if you can. If it's a problem, then you can use ours. And then we'll do some collective cleaning of the center, bringing it back into shape just before we leave. Yes?
So if you come early and then leave late, is that time, aside from the 2 days, is that time just on your own there?
Yes. I think it's nice to let the registrar know approximately when you're going to come. It's best to come in the late afternoon or evening, because otherwise, I think that, I don't know when the managers, there's people coming there to be there to support our retreat. I don't know when they arrive, but they arrive the day before. So if you come late afternoon or early evening, that'd be good.
The day before.
Day before, yeah.
Is the bed a twin bed?
I can't hear you when you speak.
Oh, is the bed a twin bed?
Yes.
Awesome.
And we wear masks the whole time.
Yeah, we'll wear masks the whole time. But we can go outside and take it off. We just indoors. Yes.
And then during the regular 2-day retreat part, they feed us just like you would on a regular retreat.
Yeah, there'll be people coming specifically to cook for us. Volunteers are coming, so there'll be food. They'll cook a lunch and supper the first day, and breakfast and lunch the second day. Mm-hmm. So then again, if you stay over Saturday night, there's no promise of food, but there might be leftover food from the 2 days that you could have. And we'll see if it's possible. In the past, before COVID, we always would go when we were down there on Friday to visit the community college at the anatomy lab. And it's a wonderful visit, and we visit with these cadavers that they're using for educational purposes. And when there's the anatomist is just an inspired person to be with. And it's very touching. And to be there with her and being there with the people who've offered their bodies for this purpose. So I couldn't reach her last year, and so it's been a while, but I'm hoping I can reach her this year. And the most current issue of Tricycle has an article by Juliana Sloan, who was in our program some years ago, and she writes about that experience. She says it was one of her highlights of her life, I think, in the article. To go there, and I mean, it's surprising in an anatomy lab to have that be the case. So I have a copy of the article, and I'll somehow get it posted on the website or something, so you can see one person's experience of visiting the lab. And then the final thing is that the second half of the tuition is due now in this month, so whenever you want to do that, but it'd be kind of nice, a little bit convenient if you could do it relatively soon. Mail it in, the Sati Center also is run by volunteers, and so the volunteer people doing the bookkeeping, it just helps them if it can be done relatively soon. Okay. So,
I have a question. How much is the second payment?
Sorry?
How much is the second payment?
Well, I'm not. It's usually people, the payment are this equal, the first half and the second half.
Okay.
So, some people have done a little bit more the first time. So, whatever you paid last time, but I can look it up some other time to see what you paid or what you're due if you want to.
Oh, no, I'll look it up. I'll look it up. I just wasn't sure.
Okay.
Yes, Sri?
I was talking to Vanessa yesterday, and she wanted to know if we could get... Oh, yeah. That's what I figured. A show of hands about who would be interested in coming on the 21st, right? 21st,
22nd, or 28th, 29th.
Yeah, but if she wanted to do it on the 21st, but she can't, there's other dates. And so if you can make it to the 21st, could we just get a show of hands... Oh, cannot make it. Oh, no, no, if you can make it. If 21st is good for you. Okay. And then maybe, what's the interest? Would people want to go on to the second essay help or want help with, can I get a show of hands there if you would actually attend that? So she's having a second round of essay help, like another webinar. Would you want to come to it?
Yeah.
Okay, so then she put three other dates in the Slack channel. Respond directly to her. What dates would work for you?
Oh, I thought we were supposed to talk about it today.
I guess we could. I mean,
is that what you said?
We make it quick for her. Yeah, sure. Let's do the dates. Okay, I'm not going to be able to do that all right there. One sec.
What did you say the options were?
21st, 22nd.
Or
28, 29. So. Oh, okay. Or Sunday. Yeah, can you hear Sharon and AJ and Leticia when they don't have when they're holding the mic? Like Shri, when he just spoke now, could you hear him? No, so, yeah, so we.
So Vanessa is available.
Hello? Yeah. Vanessa is available on 21st, 22nd, 28th, 29th. So we are doing a quick poll to find which day works for the majority of the people.
At
9 a.m. Yeah, that's right.
I just thought of one more announcement. Are we done with that?
One second. Do we want to do, like, count it off? Like, the 21st. Okay, so 21st doesn't work for anyone. The 22nd is a Sunday at 9 a.m. Raise your hand. Okay. So I got five there. The 28th, which is the next week Saturday, I can also make that. If you want, I can make that as well. Okay. Or the 29th. So was that five as well?
I think it was five again. I couldn't see K. So
okay.
That would be the 22nd or the 29th.
Okay.
Oh, how about your people online? Do you have a...
Oh, right.
I didn't look at your hands. For the 22nd, how many can do? Just two. And the 28th, how many of you can do? The 28th, Sunday?
No, Saturday.
Saturday? So the 22nd wins.
Oh,
29th. What about the 29th of January, Sunday? No, so I think that the 22nd has the most people. Yeah.
Tell her
right now.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Done?
Yep. Okay, Jennifer.
Okay, the last announcement is, given the weather, we thought we'd end early today. We're going to aim for 3:45.
Would you like that? Some of you don't care too much, but it might be a little kind of chaplaincy involvement to kind of make it easier to come home. Who knows what's on the traffic on the roads these days, today?
There's a new crater on Highway 92.
Another one?
Not a second one, but that whole highway is closed, so it's going to be really bad.
It's pouring up here, just absolutely pouring. It's been terrible.
So just with one major highway closed, I think you all will have more daylight time to get home rather than going home in the dark. And you're all warriors for getting there this morning, those of you that are in the room, so kudos. All right, we're going to move on.
Can I ask a quick question? This is for the people in the room. I was going to be taking Caltrain back north to San Francisco, but does anyone happen to be driving like straight to San Francisco? Alan? Okay, we'll talk. Thank you.
Cool.
Okay, Jennifer.
Once more with feeling. Okay, great. So, why don't we all stand up and just shake it off a little bit, all these logistics. Shake your feet. Shake your legs. Turn to the left. Turn to the right. I went to a balance class yesterday, and they recommended walking backwards if you're over the age of 40 on a regular basis. So you can try just walking backwards. Don't bump into anything. I thought that was pretty interesting. And then also, if you walk forward, to put one foot in front of the other, touching your toes, that's another balancing exercise. And he reminded us that our heads weigh 11 pounds, but if you look down, they're even heavier. So don't look down while you're doing it. Okay, let's come back to our chairs. Maybe we should do that for walking meditation, incorporate things for aging bodies, including walking backwards. That would be something in the meditation hall, wouldn't it? Fat heads, exactly. So if you're looking, if your head weighs 11 pounds and you look down, it weighs even more. Like it propels you forward. Okay, so new topic. So we're on the parami of wisdom. And I wanted to read to you something from the Zen tradition in the San Francisco Zen Center lineage. There's quite a bit of chanting at what are called services, morning, noon, and night. And there's different chants on different days. And one of them, there's a chant to the perfection of wisdom. So I thought I'd read this to you and I'll put it on the website. Yeah. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. The perfection of wisdom gives light. Unstained, the entire world cannot stain her. She is a source of light, and from everyone in the triple world, she removes darkness. Most excellent are her works. She brings light so that all the fear and distress may be forsaken, and disperses the gloom and darkness of delusion. She herself is an organ of vision. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray from it. The perfection of wisdom of the Buddhas sets in motion the wheel of dharma. I imagine some of you have heard this before, some of you have not. I think one thing of note is the use of the pronoun she. There's also some incredible language here, like unstained and the triple world, and she is an organ of vision. I would imagine that Gil did not talk about wisdom as an organ of vision this morning, so I'm adding this imagery to your consideration. And Also in this chant is, she brings light so that all fear and distress may be forsaken, which has a real theistic feel to it to me, for me, you know. But I was thinking that compassion without wisdom can be off, or not, things can be unclear sometimes. So I want to talk about a particular activity for chaplains that brings light and reduces fear and distress. Or elsewhere in the chant, it says, she has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas. So this is also an activity that chaplains do, where they use their knowledge as well as their hearts, their caring, their compassion. Yeah. And the activity is called spiritual assessment. Spiritual assessment. So I'm going to teach you now a little bit about spiritual assessment. We'll do some thinking together. And then I will have some documents for you as a follow-up. Spiritual assessment in healthcare settings has become very popular because in healthcare settings, other professionals are doing assessments. In the clinical model, a typical healthcare model, there's kind of like engaging, gathering information, deciding what's happening and what needs to be done, coming up with a plan, and then doing that plan, and then reevaluating. So that's kind of the intervention cycle. So if I was there, I would draw a big circle on the board, but I'll show it to you here. Can you see that? Somebody say yes or no.
Yes, we can see it.
Yeah.
Great. So at the top it says, start here. Gather information. And then over here, it's a needs assessment. And we're going to get into this. A care plan and then implementation. And these red arrows are really important because it's not a linear process. It's circular. Because once you do something, then there's more information to be gathered. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Can you show it one more time, but not have it so close?
Sure.
A little bit closer. A little bit closer, closer. That's good. And then a little bit to your right. Perfect. Thank you.
Sure. And I'll get this on the course website. Yeah. Can I take it down now?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Spiritual assessments are also a way to communicate between disciplines. So let's say if you were on duty one day and I was on duty the next, you know, you could put in a note somewhere in the appropriate place for what happened and what you think the person needs, so that I can continue with the care plan and don't necessarily have to gather all the information first, you know. It's also a tool for evaluating what happens. So let's say I see a situation, I have an idea, I come up with a plan, I do it, and then I can see how that goes. You know, did that lower the person's spiritual distress, for example? Was the person, through our engagement, able to come to a decision or after providing a ritual, does the person seem more at ease in the middle of their trauma? And then in healthcare settings, spiritual assessments also, healthcare is very, for better or for worse, oriented around outcomes. And not just outcomes, but measurable outcomes. So through doing particular models of spiritual assessment, chaplains can demonstrate their contribution to the mission of the institution for accountability, and not really a word you might think of in terms of spiritual care, but quality assurance. Yeah. And some of that involves learning a particular language or lexicon to use with certain people who are just used to that kind of language. It's not really a place for us to start in introducing you to spiritual assessment, but it's just something I wanted to let you know. Yeah. If you go on to do more training as a chaplain, you'll learn more. Yeah. And one more aspect of spiritual assessment is often it's tied in with one's own chaplain identity. So some people, their spiritual assessment, the way they approach it, is congruent with how they see the world through the lens of theology or dharmology or interpersonal dynamics or cultural identities. So that there's a handful of reasons why assessment's important, and I will also add this list here to the course website under in this section. Yeah. I remember when I had a puppy who was like 7 weeks old, and I've put her first collar on her, and she was like, you know, she did like this thing, like she kept trying to get out of the collar, you know. I think learning a spiritual assessment is a little bit like that for us as chaplains, is at first it's like, get this thing off me. I just came here to be present. You know? But actually, I think by looking clearly, like the organ of vision, the bodhisattva, the perfection of wisdom, you'll see that you are already gathering information and receiving requests of one kind or another. You're already making choices around, you know, left or right. You know, this person mentioned six things. Which one do I want to think is important to ask more about? You know, and as a beginner, sometimes we pursue things because we have something in common with them, or we're just really curious. And as we mature, we learn which questions will yield the most fruit for the person we're caring for. Yeah, if that makes sense. Yeah. So part of this includes, which may feel like a little more of a lightweight collar, more of like a cat collar than a dog collar maybe, is to think about, although this word is, for every person, you can create a spiritual profile. Now, as I use the word profile, I'm a little anxious because I think of profiling, you know, which, and yet we could call it an individual spiritual, maybe snapshot would be a better, you know, something that's in this moment and could change any time down the road, right? But I'd like to collaborate with you guys and see if we can together list out different aspects of somebody spiritually if we took a snapshot of them. So let me think of, so let's say, let's choose a figure from history. Can somebody choose a person from history that we can do a spiritual profile of them, based on some of our common knowledge? First person I thought about was Cleopatra, but we could popcorn out some other ideas. Shakyamuni Buddha, Ananda, Mara.
Gandhi, someone said.
Say again?
Gandhi.
Gandhi. Okay, let's do Gandhi. I like it. Thank you. What was that?
Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela, yeah. So, if using the microphone, please, and this will be slow and tedious with our virtual hybrid format here, so bear with us. When you think of Gandhi, what do you know about him in terms of his spiritual identity, profile? What are the aspects of him spiritually that might be important and relevant at a time of difficulty? So I'm going to name the first one, which is what religion he identifies with, or what's sometimes called faith identity. So that's one thing we learn about people, or may find out, either when we're talking to them, or sometimes if you get a list of people, it may say something on that list, although it's half the time it's incorrect. I saw somebody grab my phone. Was that Alan? What else, Alan?
Deeply committed to nonviolence.
Or was it not Alan?
Yeah. Hello?
I don't think the mic is working.
Could you hear him? No, is your mic on?
Can you hear
him? We can't hear him talk.
We heard it just now.
You heard him now? Okay, go ahead. Say it again.
Deeply committed to nonviolence.
Great. Commitment to nonviolence. So you could say that's one of his practices, and as well as a vow he's taken. Yeah. Thank you. Great. What else?
I would say compassionate, particularly toward those who have less.
Right. So kind of focused on other people's life situations.
Mm-hmm. And I would also say selfless, willing to sacrifice.
Right. So one thing that's important to him is to not have it be all about him, to use modern language. Right. Yeah. Concern for others is high. Right.
Yeah, he also did introspection one day per week. He spent a lot of time looking inwards to see how he can lead better. So I don't know what you want to say, but...
Right. Thank you. So introspection, daily introspection is another practice. Yeah.
Willingness to be wrong.
Willingness to be wrong.
I only say that because I do know one fun fact. He was kind of pro-colonial at one point and was recruiting Indians to go to fight in World War I as a way of shaking off British rule, but then changing his mind, right. Be like, oh, maybe we can do this another way.
Right. So you might say that his spiritual or religious beliefs shaped his perspective and it changed. My impression is the deeper his spiritual practice, the more he did change his mind and see things differently. Yeah. So sometimes in chaplaincy language, we would talk about that as, is there a lens through which people are looking at their current crisis? You know? Yeah. So one of his lenses was, you could say, nonviolence.
One more thing, non-harming.
And non-harming, right. Did he have any significant relationships?
Well, his wife, Kasturi, she died young. So, but he did have a couple of children, so a couple of kids. Now his grandkids, great-grandkids, yeah.
But he had a lot of followers that he was in relationship with on a regular basis, correct?
I believe so, yeah.
And he formed a community, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. AJ?
I'm not sure how this fits in, but when you mentioned him, I thought the first word that came to mind, we don't really have a good word for it in English, but I miss it in these conversations, and it's consequent. He walks the walk that he talks. We don't really have one word to say that. in English, but the follow through, like he believed something, he espoused something, and he did the thing, and it all matched.
Right. Thank you.
No cognitive dissonance.
Right. Did somebody else say something else right when I called on AJ? Do you think ritual was important to Gandhi?
Probably. I'll throw out one little factoid. He had the Spanish flu terribly, and I think it killed some of his family as well. So contact with deep suffering.
Sorry? I can't hear you.
Muted on the computer.
Huh? It's muted. But is someone trying to speak here? No, my muting is not affecting that. Is it?
I think we're just waiting, AJ, for them to get their audio.
Oh. Did you hear what I said?
I see somebody with a microphone, so I'm just waiting.
Jennifer, can you hear me?
So you did not lose audio, AJ.
I don't think that makes a difference.
Hello? Okay. Jennifer?
I hear you now. Yeah, okay. You got to talk.
Okay. I don't know how it necessarily fits in, but he had the Spanish flu and killed some of his family members. He had it really bad. Like, he was on death's door a few times, so I guess deep contact with physical suffering is part of his lens of seeing the world.
Do we know if he took medication for his healing?
Not entirely sure.
Related to ritual, I believe one, the observable thing about Gandhi was that he had very few possessions. I believe, mm-hmm. He had this, he was, I don't know whether it's about poverty, but... Yeah, it was
in communion with the. So he lived a very simple life, right? So he wove his own clothes, just trying to be, independent of depending on the British imported textiles. That was the logic behind that. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Great. So these objects and what he had were expressions of his faith.
Right.
Right. Right. He also had. Probably different terms of endearment or titles that people called him or he called himself. We don't know what did he identify as a renunciate or a clergy person, or did he eschew those terms? But these, when we're looking at a spiritual snapshot of somebody, who are they spiritually? These are all the aspects of who they are.
So, Jennifer, to your question, he was called Mahatma. So Mahatma means a great soul. So that's not his name,
right.
but that's what people call.
Right. So then if he was in the clinic, I'd be like, does he want to be called Mahatma? And do I put that in the charting so that everybody calls him Mahatma? Or the person may say to me, I don't want to use my spiritual name while I'm here in the hospital. So, this is a great spiritual profile of Gandhi. Thank you. I'm going to review based on this sheet I have in front of me, then I'll get to you guys. So one was, what is the person's faith identity? How do they identify? They may have seen a form where they checked a box or left it blank when they entered the setting where you're meeting them. Or people may check off Catholic, but then when I meet with them, they say, I'm an ardent Catholic, I'm a born-again Catholic, I'm a Byzantine Catholic. Christmas is not until January 5th. It's not the 25th of December, it's January 5th. I'm an Irish, I trained at an Irish Catholic hospital, so... The people I met were like, I'm an Irish Catholic and we built the city of San Francisco, which of course is a great offense to the other people who built the city, including the immigrant Chinese. So faith identity. Second is religious or spiritual beliefs. And this one, you guys really were keen on that a lot came forward, nonviolence, non-harming, integrity. Religious or spiritual practice is a third. So one of his practices was what he wore, right? Meditation. One of his practices was to be barefoot, and in the healthcare setting, you know, people keep telling him to put his shoes on, you know, so I might, part of my assessment might be to educate other people about this person's spiritual values and needs, because maybe what I hear from Gandhi is, you know, I want people to stop telling me to put my shoes on because I'm not going to, you know, this is part of my spirit. And then we counter with, well, we have health standards, you know, and it's not safe for other people. So it's a practice of non-harming to at least put these socks on. You know, like we would negotiate that, I think. You know. Perspective on his current crisis. So through the lens of his beliefs, that's why I asked about the Spanish flu. Did he take medication? Was there an inoculation or vaccination at the time? So particularly in healthcare, you know, people have a perspective on whether this was a sudden event or a planned event. They have thoughts and feelings about who's there with them. They have a viewpoint on, like I noticed today, I was at a medical appointment this morning and I referred to one side of my body as the bad side. I said, oh, that's my bad side. And I thought, why am I saying that? You know, that's not at all helpful, you know, but it's like this little view of like my own dissatisfaction with the, you know, my left hip to my ankle of late. So I would listen for that. And I wouldn't necessarily as the chaplain come back at them and say, don't be so hard on yourself, but I would note it. Do you know what I mean? Like, so all these things are not directly question and answer, but these are the things I look for that are little clues. A decision-making style. Like, would Gandhi decide something on his own? Or would he need time to decide? Or would he have a council of elders or family that he would want to talk to in order to make a decision? Or would he say, I want to pray on it. I need 48 hours, you know? Yeah. Decision-making style is very big in healthcare, depending on multiple cultural factors. Some people don't make decisions on their own, you know, for example, they make them, they would say this is a communal decision, you know. Spiritual or religious concerns, or like Gandhi might have the concern, like, is my food vegetarian? You know, was it cooked in a vegetarian kitchen? You know, or people may have spiritual concerns like tomorrow's Easter, or it's the high holy days. I should be fasting, you know, for Rosh Hashanah. Like, I didn't bring, I meditate and I forgot my electronic candle, but I love to meditate with a candle. You know, like, again, what are the spiritual or religious concerns? Or like, is it wrong for me to have this procedure? You know, is it morally wrong? Is it spiritually or religiously long? This comes into play particularly around things like reproduction and organ donation and procedures that extend one's life, you know. So in some ways you could say people's religion or spirituality impacts the choices they make. And even their coping, like, is it a resource for their coping? And so their coping, what I would say is, like, you can also evaluate on a spiritual distress being low, medium, or high, and you can see indicators. So I might say, this person's spiritual distress seems low, and then in engaging with them, I come to understand that they're doing their practices while they're hospitalized. You know, they're accessing whatever it is that they access in their regular lives is available to them, you know. Or it's high because they're used to practicing in community. And so it's Wednesday. They have a Wednesday group. They're not getting to their Wednesday group. You know, is there a way that I can embody community for them on a Wednesday, for example? And then what are the sources of strength and even hope for them? Or what are the sources of healing for them? You know, what do people believe about healing? Do they use that word? I have found that the question, where do you get your strength from, is a benign enough inquiry where people can go towards family, towards God, towards themselves. So it's a great, in regards to ultimate concerns, asking about strength and resources is relatively benign. And so it's a good one. Yeah, that's a good little tool to put in your pocket. Rather than saying, do you believe in God? You can say, you seem really kind of solid and strong. Is that just who you are? What do you do to kind of keep yourself so strong? And then significant relationships. Gandhi had people around him that were greatly impacted by his decisions. And then lastly, there's people's personal interests. Like maybe Gandhi was a bird watcher, or Gandhi did Gandhi have a guru? I know I'm leaning on people who grew up in India for this kind of information, but no, okay.
Yes and no. I think at some point he had guru, but I think towards the later part of his life, he did a lot more introspection, just kind of going inwards and critical decision-making time. So
super. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
So as you can see, would you agree with me that you're already gathering this kind of information all the time when you're engaging with people? It's implicit or it's explicit. You found out from them or you found out from somebody else about them. Yeah. Is there any area of this kind of that seems more tender or you might be hesitant to ask them about or things that seems a little beyond the pale, beyond the norm, I should say? Is there a question here or an area that if you met a stranger, you would or would not talk about? Is that Kristen?
Yes. Hello.
Okay. Can't quite tell with the mask, but I thought it was. Thanks.
Yeah. I have a question, knowing that there may not be an answer, which is like I can see how in gathering information we can form a profile, but yet part of me is afraid that I will start stereotyping someone based on said profile. Sure. and knowing how right. much to ask versus how much I can safely assume, if at all.
Right. I think you can safely assume that there's a fair amount of stereotyping going on.
Okay. Great.
In one form or another. Or you could say it's prior knowledge. You know, so I did encounter, for example, that many Irish Catholic seniors in 1998, when I was training as a chaplain, looked at me and said, "You're not the priest, you know, you're not a sister. What are you doing here?" You know, like, and is that stereotyping or just data? You know, like, 4 out of 5 people think I'm Catholic, you know, and then I'm a sister, a clergy person, a nun, you know. So, if I was in a 12-step setting, I would assume that people had very few spiritual resources because in my view, my theology of spiritual care in an addiction and recovery context would be that there is a spiritual solution to addiction. And so people in active addiction have low resources or low access to spiritual resources, for example. Yeah. So I think I wouldn't use it as a, put it in front of me between us and then make sure that you match that stereotype. But it is something that would come across my mind and then I would hold that lightly when I go and engage with that person. Because some of it's just, it's just true. And I would even say like some Filipinos, you know, are very devout, and prayer was very important to them, and other Filipinos, it's not, you know. I'm wondering about you, you know, since we've been talking about your Filipino heritage and family, and you're a big part of the Filipino community here in South San Francisco. So I might even acknowledge and bring in the what I thought might be possible. And then it doesn't matter whether I'm right or wrong, because we're engaging, you know, and I hopefully can do it in a way that's not overly off-putting, although once in a while it might be. Who knows?
Thank you.
Yeah. Does that get to some of your question, Kristen?
Yes, that was very helpful.
Okay.
I would say that the section of our spiritual profile that I would be most concerned about is actually the significant relationships part. There's like a, you know, kind of aphorism, like, don't ask questions you don't want to know the answers to. And like, sometimes people don't have like super happy, helpful relationships.
Right. So if I am a polyamorous person, I may not tell my provider that at our first meeting, because who knows how they'll treat me if they learn that about me, and I need to be smart about how much I disclose, right? Right. Somebody else may have found that out and put it in the chart, and I might see it in the chart and think to myself, I will see if they want to tell me about this or not, you know, leave some power with them around that, you know. And in creating a profile of somebody, if there's blanks, if I don't know things and they don't tell me, I think part of the practice is to be understanding and not feel like I'm entitled to all this information about you just because I'm this benign person who came in the room. You know, you can keep some secrets from me, or maybe you would tell me later, you know. Or sometimes people tell you something the last 5 minutes of your meeting, you know. As people do in therapy, in like the last 5 minutes, they say, can be very, a little bomb gets dropped and then people walk out of the room. So thank you for that, Sage. Okay. So according to our wheel, we've gathered information, and now we're going to make an assessment and a plan. So a really simple way, and I've referred to it already, is just to, one assessment can simply be, is there spiritual strength or access to resources, low, medium, or high? And those resources or those sources of strength vary depending on each individual. But nonetheless, you know, I might, you know, meet one IMC Vipassana practitioner in room A and then go to room B and meet another one just by happenstance. And one may be like, oh yeah, I'm listening to talks and I've been sitting and, you know, like somebody brought me my beads and, you know, like, my peer group are calling me, and the person in the next room might be like, I can't get there tonight and I'm just adrift. I don't feel at all connected like I would on the usual Tuesday when that's my day to go provide service at IMC. So it can be completely different. Yeah. Does that make sense? And so I think low, medium, high, what is low, medium, or high? Well, then that's just one rubric. You know what I mean? But in certain settings, it's something that people understand, because people are very confused by the work of chaplains. So keeping it really simple is helpful. So I can say, like in a team meeting, well, in regards to their spiritual resources or their spiritual strength, I would assess them as on a scale of 1 to 5 at a 2. So that just gives you a picture. And my plan is, and we'll get to the plan in a minute, to do X, Y, and Z, you know, and I will report back to you. And then we're going to meet in 2 days. I come back and say, well, they were at a 2, and I think now they're at a 4. You know, so given that they're at a 4, here's what I'm going to do next. So that's kind of that gather information, make an assessment, make a plan. We could talk. We'll talk about what kind of interventions or plans are. Yeah. And then part of that is also learning what are indicators of spiritual distress. So I thought maybe you guys could help me popcorn this. What are some indicators? What would, and this crosses over, of course, into human nature. So that's a hint.
Anger.
Blaming self for illness.
And I was going to mention closing down. Like
social withdrawal.
Yes, exactly. Withdrawal, yes.
Like one word answers and just not engaging.
Some people, I heard that they have the distress, like, God is never going to forgive me kind of approach. So,
did you say God is not going to forgive me?
Yeah. Yes, I was not a good person in my life, so that kind of regret.
Right, so either an absence of connection with God or a fear of being of judgment from God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's great. Yeah.
Actually, I had one question along this line of your original question, and that is usually, a lot of cases we'll be seeing them in an encounter due to a traumatic situation, either it's end of life or something. How do we tease out whether this is a spiritual trauma versus just the trauma of the situation?
Well, I would say definitely people are not at their best when they're traumatized. You know what I mean? So like, I didn't wake up one morning and think I'm going to break my ankle today, you know, like, and I broke my ankle that day. Right. So like spiritually in the ER, I'd say, my spiritual distress, like I was blaming myself and feeling guilt and shame, and really anxious about the future. So those were like in my highly traumatized state, right? Yeah. You're right, Alan. Some of it's situational. Yeah. I think ER workers are used to people being in those states of mind and heart, you know. Did I get to your question though? Or your comment?
Yes.
Enough? Okay. It's hard to tell without seeing you, so I'm just double checking.
How about dissociation or withdrawal?
Withdrawal, right. Mm-hmm. Also, an inability to pray, you know, or do anything, a regular spiritual practice, like an interruption of spiritual practice, you know, like most days at 10 o'clock or 5, you know, like, or like my frame of mind, I can't access any mindfulness. Like I'm having trouble being in the present moment, you know. That's the IMC person might say that, you know. And I can't reach Gil. Gil's like, well, the chaplaincy council. Discouraged. Or another one is some conflict. You know, like sometimes the chaplain's there when a person's in conflict with their family over a decision, or just they're in conflict because so-and-so didn't come, you know. So that vulnerability. Yeah. Great. And then what are some indicators of spiritual strength or highly resourced? Let's just under the low, but what would be high indicators of spiritual strength and resources? Popcorning. Sorry?
Hopefulness.
Hopefulness. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I've seen in close quarters taking the pain and suffering in stride, that everything is in God's hands, as an example. So, in other words, what's the short way to say it? I'm in a good place no matter what happens to me. That kind of attitude.
Okay. Acceptance of the reality. Yeah. Acceptance of reality. Yeah.
Engaging others.
Engaging others. Yeah. Having a family as a primary support person. You know, my family's been here. They're taking turns, you know, or they're all here. Didn't you see them in the lobby? You know, they're the ones that brought all their own food.
Yeah, I was going to say something along those lines, something I've experienced with someone who was in the process of dying, showing interest and offering to help others while they're in that position. And that demonstrated to me that they had strength.
The ability to have concern and express appreciation for others. Yeah.
I think maybe a big one is having a meaning. Is that just having being able to express there's a meaning?
Right, being able to express one's understanding or meaning making of the situation. You know, I think this is what's on my mind. You know, I'm wrestling with having done this thing like falling down a flight of stairs, you know, and I'm pondering how I might approach this now that it's happened. You know, I'm not just mad that it happened. And these things are not necessarily sequential, but like I'm looking at this through the lens of my own belief system or my practices. So any kind of application of meaning making is an indicator that somebody's tuning in,
yeah. One more thing which comes to my mind based on my dad's last days is surrounded by love. So he had a lot of good karma in his life, so there were a lot of people willing to help him out in the last days.
Right, yeah. So that speaks also to their activity in the community, or connection to community is strong, you know.
If I may revisit the indicators of spiritual distress, I see that some of them seem to overlap with mental health.
Yes.
Distress, and I'm not sure how to distinguish them.
Well, I would say that in general, spiritual care and mental health care, okay, are overlapping circles, and they share some territory. I'm sorry, these are the biggest circles I have with me right now. There's overlapping territory because we're talking about human nature. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our work with them is interpersonal, like that we are the resource for them to heal, as compared to, I'm going to come back with this needle or this prescription or this test. Like, so the social workers and so there's a lot of shared territory. And my experience is that getting to questions of meaning, sources of strength, thinking about the bigger picture is, unless it's initiated by the patient, mental health care providers, most, I'm not going to speak for all, don't go there. They just don't go there, you know. They'll come out and say, okay, I know all about their family, their finances, their education, their home, their work, their hobbies, but I don't know why they requested a vegetarian meal. Or, no, I didn't notice the crucifix hanging on the board where I went in, and so I said, oh, you had a vegetarian meal and there's a crucifix on your bedside table. So let's talk about that. You know, like I would see it differently. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it also depends on the context. So it could be that people don't get to see a mental health worker, but they do get to see a chaplain, or vice versa. And I think coming to this training has helped a lot of mental health workers of various identities begin to think, or even other providers like nurses or nonprofit leadership, you know, to say, how can I bring a more holistic approach to the people in my care, which includes their spirituality. So some of this training is to help orient you towards getting used to, for example, asking somebody how important is, or do you have a belief system or a way of thinking about your illness that would be good for me to know about as your fill in the blank, you know? And a lot of articles are in healthcare about helping non-chaplains assess for spiritual needs. And that's relatively new in like the last probably 20 years. You know? So there's a few models that are taught. Because a lot of nurses in particular are doing screening, you know, when people are entering a particular setting, or an intake manager or the person at the front desk. And so, I mean, you can ask somebody like a bunch of questions and say, do you have a clergy person we want to call? You want me to call? You know, or like, can you tell me which of these you might check the box on? And then go on with like, so when was your last bowel movement? You know, like it doesn't really. And so that to me is a person who's not that comfortable with those kinds of questions, because it could lead somewhere they're not trained to go, but at least it can create a flag for the chaplain to go later, you know, compared to, oh, well, I have a lot of questions to ask you. And this one's kind of a little bit beyond the normal question you might expect for somebody in my position. But because our approach here is about caring for the whole person, I just want to ask you a question or two about how you make sense of life, or even your spiritual or your religious identity, you know, and then ask a couple questions, you know what I mean? And then think about when you ask them, and then do you want to pause or even offer something back? Like, thank you, I'm going to write this. Does that sound accurate? You know, like to give it to some attention, you know what I mean? Compared to just moving on to, you know, when was the last time you did I was with my mother-in-law once at admission to a hospital, and I'm not kidding, the questions took 90 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And like the fifth to last question was, is there a clergy person you want us to call? And then just kept going. And I was like, wow, you know, like that tells me a lot about the institution or this, you know, like it was bizarre. But so it goes. This is, you know, the church and the state divorced a long time ago. And even though they flirt with each other, there's a lot of fear. They don't really, like, it's just across the room, batting of the eyes and slyly smiling. There's, you know, church and state are still like their own entities, just like church and science, you know, since Descartes have been like, we're not connected. So you can tackle that, but it could take a few thousand years.
Okay. Thank you.
These are great questions, guys, and great thoughts. I want to talk a little bit about interventions or what we might do given what we have figured out so far.
Can I throw out one thing real quick?
Yeah.
That I'd just like to offer as part of my personal training practice, when I kind of do an intake, I say the purpose of this is to put together the mosaic that's you. And so reframing the, like, I'm doing an intake, I'm going to have to check all these boxes. Like, it's a more of a dialogue, and because, right, I don't know, a little more artistic and might resonate with someone.
I like that word mosaic. I haven't heard that before. That says something, you know, that you're multifaceted. Yeah. Yeah. And I acknowledge that. Yeah.
Could I quickly add that yesterday I had occasion for a UCSF social worker to call me, and I was on the other end of one of those checklists, an institutional checklist. And it was, you know, even though the person was rather skillful, it was such a sad experience because it was all set up to fill out the form, and there was nothing genuine that actually happened. Right. And it was just an exercise in alienation. Yeah. And it was supposed, and so on their end, they have the thing, well, we checked off, we sent the social worker. And on my end, it's like, it was just it was made it worse. And I guess I was, you know, it's, so I like what Conrad just said. I mean, I just, it's like, how do you do a form or fill out, you know, ask the questions without making the other person feel like
an object?
Right? Yeah, that you're just filling out the form for right. the form's sake. And you know it, but they don't know it because they've been doing that job so long and they're so overworked and understaffed and underfunded that.
Or they just get credit for getting the checklist done. They don't get credit for how you feel.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think there's such a danger to any, you know, and but you want the questions. I mean, the sad thing is it's such a lost opportunity.
Well, that's so then the next person say, is there a chaplain that can call me? This was a little lopsided for me.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, and then the dilemma is it would have been inappropriate for her to ask that question.
So
in that context, so it's like, how do you funnel it to a helpful.
This is why these institutions need us, you know, to fill in the blanks. You know, I don't know if we can get rid of these things that are immensely practical and useful for a lot of things. You know, I want this data in my chart, and at the same time, some care, some comfort, some shared humanity, subject to subject wrapping would be really nice, you know. And that's also why we say when you're being a chaplain, like, it's not so good to fire a lot of questions at people, you know, one or two questions and then a reflective comment, you know. And you can gather information through your eyes, through your ears, through your gut, through other people, through what's in the room. You know, so I'm not proposing that you go through 30 questions, everybody. I'm just trying to give you the spirit of what are the kinds of things we learn about people, and then what does that tell us about them and how we might serve them. Yeah. Yeah. And, objectifying people is just a bad idea all around. We can all agree on that.
Is there an expectation that the spiritual assessment is filled in the first visit completely, to your point?
It depends on the institution. It depends on the setting, you know. I mean, if it's in the ER, you know, the chart might say introduced spiritual care to patients and family made aware of our services and that we will circle back within 36 hours. So it's like an initial just planted the seed, triaged, you know, if you will. And then, and then when we circle back, FYI, there were lots of family members, and it'll be interesting to see whether they're all still around another day, or if I just saw there were six family people, then I would go in 2 days later thinking, are they still here? And what's that like? So again, it's not that the person tells me what it's like to have six people there and then not there, but I'm doing that math or making those connections. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Are there just a handful or three or four questions on the assessment that if you're going to get any of it, you know, because I do think to AJ's point, it can feel like within the scope of all the questions you're being asked when you're in an institution, and I've been in a hospital, I know, it's like you do feel like a piece of meat. So is there...
So, yeah. So a great one is not the question, how are you? Because that's evaluative. And we want people to describe and reflect. So I might say, so what's this been like for you so far? I'm sure you didn't wake up this morning, or maybe you did, but I'm wondering what your day's been like. So that tells you, I want to hear what you're experiencing. I'm not bounding it by certain kind of, you know, material. That's a great one. Or people have lots of feelings when they're, you know, here. What kind of feelings and thoughts are running through your mind today or right now? You know, really broad, but enough of an invitation. And then further on, like, so I think of people sometimes as being spiritually resourced at, you know, kind of like low, medium, or high. And does that make sense to you at all? Would you think of yourself as a spiritual person? Or if you were to think about low, medium, and high for yourself, like, I but it might even just be explicit about it, or just say, where do you get your strength from, you know? And they may say, I don't have any, and that's fine. Yeah. So those are some very broad, you know, and you'll, I don't want this to be like, here's your list of questions, guys, next time you're, you know, but it's giving you an idea, again, of spiritually what happens for people and how we might use our wisdom to address that skillfully. And a lot of the interventions look like affirmation, listening, and eliciting a person's story, you know, like sacred story, grief facilitation, guided imagery, like we practiced with Gil, you know, offered prayer or went and got them a rosary, you know, these are all the interventions, you know. They're a nanosecond, if you will, in the larger context of companioning somebody. We don't want to lose sight of that kind of holy company, you know. And yet we do want to be able to write a few things down and bring some of that light of wisdom. We might even say companionship, you know, just I provided companionship in during their loneliness or while they waited, you know. Or I helped them say a good goodbye, you know, they were being discharged. And so we celebrated their discharge. Yeah. So those are the kind of interventions you would just, big statements. Some other ones would be supported or enabled patients' decision-making. Like maybe they were trying to decide whether to go home this morning or later today. Or provided education about managing one's feelings. You know, like we talked about being aware of one's feelings and not being kind of kidnapped by them, you know. And so I did a little just guided visualization about seeing your anger so as not to be kind of have it, you know, like this, you know, offer a little perspective on strong feelings. Listened to their spiritual or religious thoughts and shared a sacred text. Read them a poem and discussed, you know. Recommended self-compassion or self-forgiveness, you know, and encourage them to use their spirituality as a resource, you know, to not throw it out the window because they're in a trauma, but to really maybe have it move it into the center of their awareness. Help them say a good goodbye, particularly around end of life stuff with family, you know, facilitating goodbyes, you know, providing education about the dying process, helped family set realistic goals for this time period, you know, and we discussed realistic expectations, you know, like, because I might have said to somebody, if you feel really hyper or really tired, just know that sometimes grief shows up in our bodies like that, that you're going through a lot right now and may not realize it, but just to be kind to yourself and realize that that's just what grief looks like. It's not always tears and wailing, you know, so that's part of grief education. Yeah.
Okay. If I ask a quick question.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about like very specific interventions around like rituals and like stuff that is helpful for people, and I'm just wondering if there's a good way to ask like people about that without, you know, putting off people who are like a little bit less religious or worried about like asking. Like,
I missed the one word that you said you might offer somebody.
I totally forgot what I said. So I think just, is there a good way to ask that the question of like, can I bring you anything, or like, are there specific rituals you're interested in without?
Okay, got it. Yep. So. So one is I look for clues in the room to bring up religion. You know? Secondly, my own name tag or role as a spiritual care person is an invitation, you know. And remember how I dressed last month? You weren't there, Sage, but Gil and I came in like our clergy outfits, and I had a brooch on that had like a Buddha and a Winnie the Pooh and a Om symbol and a cross and a Jewish star and a tag that said chaplain. So
that sounds, you know, really cool.
And But it's okay to ask. You know, it's not as personal as saying, what kind of sex do you like? I know it might feel like that. Leticia's dying over there. You didn't think I was going to say that, did you? Surprise! We'll leave that to the doctors. So, a lot of people like to pray when they're in a crisis, or some people have a lucky stone in their pocket. Can I read you a poem? You know, I think keeping it really simple and letting that be a yes or no question is a great kind of, when you talked about how do you get started in that direction? And then sometimes after a while, particularly if I'm getting to know somebody, I will propose a ritual. So it doesn't have to be generated by the other person. So I was talking to one of you guys a couple of months ago, something was going on and I said, you know, I'm going to put your name on my altar and keep you in my good thoughts. And, you know, thank you for telling me today about what's happening for you. This sounds difficult, you know, and I just made that as an offering, you know. Again, this is somebody that's in this program and it seemed congruent, you know, and but I might say to somebody, how about if we sit in silence for a few minutes together? Or I brought you a poem, or how about a guided relaxation, you know? Or I want to say, we're saying goodbye. Can I show you how I like to say goodbye to people? You know? And I want to do this as we say goodbye, because for me, this was a different kind of conversation that you may be having with other people here, you know, but I want you to hold on to what we've talked about and I'll keep you in my good thoughts. So in my tradition, we bow to others when we wish them well and are grateful for having engaged with them. That might throw them off. They might like it. They might go like this back, you know, particularly if they went to Catholic school, they go like this. So some of it I ask, some of it I introduce. If there's holy days or holidays, I like for Valentine's Day, I just would always just run around with like little red hearts that I cut out and put like a big one on me and would go around and say, you know, we're celebrating love today. Would you like a little red heart? You know, and I would make them so they could like stand up on the bedside table, you know. But the first day of spring, 4th of July, Veterans Day, you know, any kind of social, it's gay pride, it's Black History Month. So I'm reading poems by women, Black women poets, or, you know, it's Asian Pacific Islanders Month. So in some ways, I'm a kind of cruise director celebrant for, and a lot of other staff in these settings don't feel empowered to celebrate those because they're worried about excluding some and including others, or not knowing how to have a difficult conversation if there is some kind of, you know. So some of them I just propose. Does that get to your question?
Yes. I think I was thinking of the problem of like, what if my like grandma was in the hospital and I tried to ask her like, what forms do you like draw in your practice? I think she would just be like, what in the world are you talking about? Versus if I said, like, do you want a rosary? She'd be like, yes, like, stay here and pray with me.
Yeah.
I was just trying to figure out how you do that, you get around that.
Yeah, and, you know, there is a fair amount of choosing one's words carefully in this work. And learning how to backpedal when you've used words that don't resonate or somebody takes offense. So you don't always have to get it right, but you gather information nonetheless, you know. And, you know, overall, we talked about presence last month, you know. I think spiritual assessment resides within offering presence to people. let's not have it be the thing. It's one thing in the larger thing, you know. Ultimately, you know, my hope is that people feel cared for. Or they have a sense of that their life matters. So one person for 5 minutes in the midst of a storm. You know. I saw an accident today and an emergency worker, like in bright yellow gear, getting rained on, helping somebody get in a vehicle. And like, I saw them put their hand on the person's arm and kind of lead them to the door because it was just buckets. And I thought, I wonder how that is for that person to kind of be guided into the car physically. Is that comforting, or was that, did they notice, or is that alienating? You know, so there's so much that's unspoken, you know, the way we enter the room, where we put our eyes, how we move our bodies. Do I talk too much with my hands and distract you from whatever we're talking about? So I would say going forward, just keep in mind, imagine whoever you're interacting with. Is there a spiritual strength noticeable, or do they seem spiritually out of gas? You know, something to kind of toy with.
Just a question I have in mind. Is there a kind of understood protocol or some easy way for the patients to know that we are here to provide spiritual care as a chaplain? Like, if I'm wearing my regular clothes, I don't have anything distinct to say that chaplain in training or anything like that, right? So any recommendations, thoughts?
What's the setting you're thinking of?
Hospital setting. Hospital, yeah.
I didn't hear your answer.
Hospital setting, in the healthcare setting.
Okay, great. So, a jacket and a collared shirt or a turtleneck. Or like a nice sweat, like zip sweater, you know, so like, I think looking a little bit sharp, you know, and then on, like we talked about last month, you know, is there a pin you could put on your lapel or a sticker on your name tag? You know, so like I've seen Hello Kitty stickers on name tags, and I've seen crosses, and I've seen little rainbow stickers where people or expressing either that they're queer friendly or that they're queer or it's Gay Pride Month. I mean, who knows? So I would, you know, you can go onto eBay and put in Dharma Wheel pin and think about getting a little Dharma Wheel pin. Put on your sweater, your collar, your name badge, you know, and experiment, you know. You can go low, medium, high with your spiritual wardrobe.
Thank you.
And then the other thing is, hold on, I got a prop to show you. This is like a little zip pouch where I can have a pencil, the list of people that I'm seeing, a rosary, a poem that I'm going to read and then leave to them, a red heart if it's Valentine's Day, breath mints, lip gloss, you know, like, and you'll see in settings, people are, I'm not a big fan of the large ones because they're almost like too big, but the ones that are like half size, I have found to be plenty big. I've also seen people kind of wear something and have it kind of tucked behind them. chaplains. So you'll figure it out. I think stickers are wonderful, like smiley stickers. You know, like put some smiley stickers. You might meet a kid in the lobby, you know. Hey, I'm the chaplain. I got it. Would you like a sticker? You know, who says no to a sticker? You can't give them candy, but you can give them a sticker. Smiley face stickers, you can get those somewhere too. Or a heart, you know. Or a star, you know. These symbols are very powerful. You know, if you don't want to do something Buddhist, you could wear a heart pin and a star pin, you know. Or if you're out and about in the trenches, maybe at a center where they care for the homeless, you know, maybe you're wearing like a crew cap, you know, but you put a pin on it, you know, or something, a conversation starter almost, you know, or a all these visual cues. It's a great question. And then this thing, you'll lose. So put your name and on it, and then buy two when you get one. And then the other, you know, of course, pace, you know, along with intervention comes pace, you know. What's the pace of the conversation? What's the pace of visit to visit to visit? You know? How much am I talking compared to how much they're talking? Ideally, I'm a third and they're two-thirds. And I've one out of three things I say is a question. One out of three. And don't take their drugs or money, and don't have sex with them. I'm just going to keep saying that. Those are the big mistakes, okay? If you get kicked out of the room, if you offend somebody, if they complain about you, that's fine. It's totally fine. You use the wrong pronoun, you just say, I apologize. Can we start over? You know. If you looked at your thing and it says Catholic and you find out they're Jewish, you know, you just say, I apologize. So, but other than a few things that are really heinous, just go make your mistakes and write about them in your next action reflection paper. Or bring them to a mentor interview or your peer or your small group. I have said to people, I'm going to leave now and come back in. Like, you know, I get kind of playful. I'm like, I have completely blown this. I'm going to leave and come back in. Can we start over? You know, most people say, they laugh and they say, okay. Because I'm already laughing at myself, you know. I often regret what I've not said compared to what I've said. Particularly with colleagues, you know. There's times I really wish I'd said out loud, that's disrespectful. The language you're using describing them seems disrespectful to me. I wish I held up human dignity more often, and that I consider part of the chaplain's job. But so most of my regrets are about not saying something rather than what I said and screwed something up. One time, here's a story. Working in hospice, residential hospice, I took 6 weeks off. I came back and a guy named David lives there, bedbound. I said to him, I'm surprised to see you. I might as well have said, I thought you'd be dead by now. He said, well, where'd you think I was going? He was quite gracious, you know. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I'm laughing about it now. At the time, I was horrified. And went screaming back to my peer group and be like, I told David I thought he'd be dead by now. That's a memorable one for sure. Okay, so I've talked a lot. We've covered some territory. I invite you to get to the documents that we post that I taught from today. And to just, you know, mull over on a scale of 1 to 5, what's this person's access to their spiritual strength, or what's their level of distress or disconnection, or whatever word you want. You can coin your own word. You might say it's their karma, or you might think of it as which type of suffering are they having right now? You know, attachment, aversion, or delusion, you know? Yeah. How far are they from their Buddha nature right now? Yeah. Do you have anything to add, Gil?
No.
Good, keep it that way. Cool. All right. So it's going on 3:30. What's the sense in the room about what's next?
So my sense is that we should take a break and then come back and finish up.
Okay.
And exactly how we finish up, I can't say, but my sense is that it would be actually kind of nice, given the whole total thing of the day, if we did the break in silence. How do the rest of you think for that? Does that seem good? So hopefully, it's good. So let's do it. And that's also, there's a little bit of cleaning up the kitchen and the bathrooms and the trash that would be great to do. And there's a little bit of blue sky out there.
Ooh.
And what's it like there where you are, Jennifer?
It's rain and cats, if not cats and dogs.
We got dogs. And.
Okay, well, so why don't we take a 15-minute break? Let's start again in here at 3:45 to bring it to an end.
Thanks, everybody.